Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Strategies for Early Diagnosis of Type 1 Diabetes in Children. I am Diana Isaacs, an endocrine clinical pharmacy specialist and CGM program coordinator at the Cleveland Clinic Diabetes Center in Cleveland, Ohio.
And I am Natalie Bellini. I'm an endocrine nurse practitioner specializing in diabetes management with University Hospitals in Cleveland, Ohio.
Today, we will discuss the importance of early screening for type 1 diabetes, screening guidelines and options, and emerging treatments that can delay the onset of type 1 diabetes. To discuss more of this, we are very fortunate to be joined today by Dr. Fran Kogan, the director of the Childhood and Adolescent Diabetes Program at Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll go ahead and dive right into it right now. So, Natalie, you want to start us off with the first question?
Sure. Can you talk to us a little bit about the importance of early diagnosis in type 1 diabetes?
Yes, I think one of the issues is that we don't want to have these children admitted to the hospital in DKA, which is diabetic ketoacidosis. Many patients don't even realize that they are ill, let alone that they've been diagnosed with a chronic disease. So the importance in terms of early diagnosis is to have people be aware of the signs and symptoms so they don't end up in the emergency room or our pediatric ICUs.
So what percentage of your patients come in one way or the other in DKA or non-DKA at diagnosis?
I would say the majority come in, let me rephrase that. It depends on when during the pandemic, the majority of our children came in DKA because they were afraid to come to the emergency rooms. So if you look at the statistics, prior to the pandemic, there were less that presented in DKA and more so during the pandemic. But now I'd say we have quite a number of patients that do present in DKA.
Can you tell us what the guidelines say about who should be screened for type 1 diabetes?
Sure. The first set of guidelines I would say would anybody with a first-degree relative, specifically, say, parents, brother, sister, or a parent that has a child with diabetes. And then, of course, you could look at more extended families, like aunts, cousins, and that sort of thing. So anyone, I would say, with a family history of type 1 diabetes should be screened. And I think those are delineated in the TrialNet requirements.
Are most people that get diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, do they have a family member that already has it?
No, actually, they do not. And that's what can be so difficult is because many people are not even aware of the possibility of having diabetes. And as you know, the risk is about 1 in every 300 in the general population.
It's low, but that's like not that low, you know? It's still, yeah.
Right, it is. Can you tell me how that's changed over the years? Like, what was it maybe 20 years ago or 30 years ago? Because I've heard that the incidence is absolutely going up.
Yes, the incidence is definitely going up. And I don't think that people can identify exactly why. If you look, there are several hypotheses. One is the viral hypothesis where you're exposed to viral infections. Of course, you know you have to have a risk where it's necessary to get type 1 diabetes, but something in the environment to trigger that risk will then cause type 1 diabetes. We do know that Coxsackie virus in the past has been shown to be embedded in the DNA of some patients. And it's been my experience that every time there's a viral epidemic, I think 10 years ago, H1N1 presented with a huge influx of new onsets. And we're also seeing little by little, the COVID diagnoses, more and more children are coming in with diabetes. And then, of course, there's the hygiene hypothesis, which people feel that children and young adults are not exposed to all of the antigens that they might have been previously many years ago, like being on the farm, you know, that sort of thing. So that may be another reason, but people don't really know for sure why there's been an increase.
So for pediatricians, how important do you think it is to discuss family history of type 1 diabetes and ask about relatives that might have type 1 diabetes?
I think it's very, very important. And, you know, when we were residents and, you know, we had the experience of asking patients about family history, we would go through all of the diseases I'm not certain that people realize that diabetes, they don't realize the risk of diabetes. And certainly we ask questions through review of systems, you know, any history of pulmonary disease, any history of GI disease. And then I would always ask any history of diabetes. But when we do ask that, we need to make sure that they understand the difference between type 2 diabetes and type 1 diabetes. So specifically, you would want to ask any autoimmune diseases. So if you ask a family history and say, oh, someone has low thyroid or high thyroid, immediately zoom in. Well, let's ask some other autoimmune questions.
We have to increase screening in order to know who is going to get it to prevent the DKAS episode when diagnosis happens. But if only 10% of people with type 1 have a relative with type 1 approximately, how do we find the rest of those people? How do we find those people that we don't know about as much or don't have as much of a risk? Are there other autoimmune disorders that you might say this person has a higher risk or not?
Yes. So as you know, there's no general screening now for type 1 diabetes. However, one should certainly start thinking of possible screening for type 1 if they have other autoimmune diseases, which we just mentioned. Particularly if they have thyroid disease, whether it's a low thyroid or high thyroid, Hashimoto's or Graves' disease, and celiac disease. Celiac disease is a very common gastrointestinal disorder that is very closely linked to the type 1 allele on chromosome 6 in the histocompatibility loci. So if someone has any GI, such as celiac, thyroid, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, and adrenal insufficiency, we would clearly want a screen for antibodies to type 1 diabetes.
Can you tell us a little more about the screening? Like, how do people get screened? What are the options?
So there are several options that you could do. Are you asking if they have a relative or out just in the community?
Well, I guess both. So it sounds like we can identify people at higher risk. So we can start with them. But then if general people wanted to get screened, is there an option for them as well?
Yes. So first of all, if in family members or relatives, we have something called TrialNet where they could get mail in, lab work, that sort of thing, or they can have it done at a site. For the general population, what I would do is do antibody screening. And general pediatricians do not even know what antibodies to get. So lately, with all the increased exposure, which I assume we'll talk about a bit, to Plumizab, many of the pediatricians are wondering, gosh, do we need to start screening our patients for diabetes antibodies?
Yeah, so kind of going more along that, what are the autoantibodies we would be looking for?
So the TrialNet actually uses 5 antibodies, and we at my institution actually use 4. So let me go over the 5 antibodies. The most common known is GAD65 antibodies. And then there's ICA antibodies, and there's IA2A antibodies. And there's another one, I'll just say zinc transporter antibody. And then there's another one that TrialNet uses called microinsulin autoantibody, which we actually, in my institution, do not screen for. We screen for the GAD65, the ICA, IA2A, and the zinc transporters. And they're pretty good. I mean, we are able to use them effectively. And then what I would recommend for a general pediatrician, I would go ahead and do the same orders. There's no harm that they can certainly do it. There are codes, from what I understand, that you can evaluate for diabetes by using these codes.
So yeah, how do you interpret these results? If the average, I guess, pediatrician was going to run these tests, like what, let's say one antibody comes back positive or two, like what do you do with that?
Well, so first of all, let's start with 0 antibodies, which is what everybody hopes. Generally, the risk is fairly low. You can't guarantee that someone's not going to get diabetes, but you could be very reassuring. 1 antibody, the risk is higher. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get diabetes, but I would recommend rescreening maybe every year or so. The one that's really scary is the 2 positive antibodies, which essentially means that somewhere in your lifetime, you will probably, well, I should say 100% chance of getting type 1 diabetes. And if you have those 2 antibodies, then we would recommend further screening with to look for any dysglycemia, either with an oral glucose tolerance test, which is what I think the TrialNet does. So to look for any irregular blood sugars, which then may be stage, we're hoping it's not stage three, which is actual diagnosis of diabetes. The ones with two antibodies are considered stage two.
So stage one then is positive antibodies. Stage two is what you call this dysglycemia, and you need to do an oral glucose tolerance test. Why can't I just do a fasting blood sugar?
Well, the reason is because carbohydrates can cause rises in blood sugars throughout the day. So it's not just the fasting blood sugar. And yes, we diagnose diabetes based on two fasting blood sugars over 126. However, I think we now know it's not just based on fasting, it's based on your response to carbohydrates. And, you know, one other way around this, which has not been necessarily approved by insurance companies, is using a continuous glucose monitor to see dysglycemia in potential stage two patients or children.
I was just going to ask that because it seems like that would be an easier way to assess it versus doing an OGTT.
I thoroughly agree with that, and we're looking into it. It's a matter of, to be honest with you, insurance companies be willing to look at the CGMs, and I think that will eventually happen. But at the moment, the way to do it is either through a mixed meal or a glucose tolerance.
And how often do you recommend doing that? Let's say it's normal and the person has two autoantibodies. How often should that be repeated?
So probably at least every year. Some families would say every 6 months. I might do it if I were anxious, especially if I had another child with diabetes, but at the minimum once a year.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, and do you know, I know you said a basically 100% chance if someone has two autoantibodies. What's the expected time frame from the presence of those to the diagnosis?
From what I understand, the trial has been like over 20 years, so at least 20 years. I would say one of my staff members, who's a nurse, does have, she's retired, but has type 1 diabetes, and her son has two antibodies, and it's been over 20 years for him. He has not gotten diabetes. So wow. That's anecdotal, okay, but it's one person. He has two antibodies.
Well, and that's interesting because, too, we see that there are people who are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at 60, 70, 80 years old. And lots of times it gets missed because we don't know that they're antibody positive. And I think that's the whole part of this is that, or the point of this rather, is that if you know, you're watching out for it, no matter what age you are.
Correct. In fact, many adults are misdiagnosed with type 2 diabetes when, you know, we're primed to understand this. And interestingly enough, our patients come in and parents say, oh, I just got diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. I go, wait a minute, let's make sure it's not type 2. Let's go check antibodies.
Yeah,
that actually found a number of parents in that situation.
Yeah, we have as well. I'm curious, are children, or I guess not even just children, but are people ever diagnosed with type 1 that just have the one antibody, or do usually two end up being present at diagnosis?
You know, that's a really good question, because lots of times, you know, kids will come in with the presentation of new onset type 1 based on criteria, you know, random blood sugar over 200 milligrams per deciliter with all of the polys and the polydipsia, polyphagia, and an elevated A1C. So they have type 1 diabetes. However, not all of them will show antibodies right away. And then we get a little, you know, saying, well, do they have diabetes or type 1 diabetes? And the answer is yes, okay, because we just may not have been able to detect those antibodies at the time. And I believe more and more antibodies will be discovered that we may not even know about at the moment. So I should say not everyone, yes, we screen, but not every single person who gets diagnosed with type 1 has all the antibodies. And then we watch. The other thing we'll do sometimes is do a MODY, check for maturity onset diabetes of youth, which is a genetic form of diabetes. But most of those kids usually do not come in with A1Cs of 14, okay? So I just want to vaguely mention that we do think of it. And if necessary, we'll do genetic testing. But generally, it's fairly clear with the type 1s.
Oh, that's so interesting about potentially other autoantibodies. That's fascinating. So let's say a pediatrician checks the child and there are two autoantibodies present. What's kind of the next step? Should a referral take place to an endocrinologist? Is it just kind of watchful waiting? Like, what's the recommendation?
Well, I think it depends on the pediatrician. I work at a big children's hospital. We know many of the general pediatricians, and I would have probably a phone call or, an email discussion. And I would probably say we do need at this point to do an oral glucose tolerance test at the minimum or CGM, we hope. And I would bring them in for a consultation. And because the other thing is I want to spend time with the families to make sure they understand what this means. Not that the pediatrician can't do it. They certainly can if they feel comfortable. But most of the time, reality is they would feel more comfortable to have the family come in to speak to us. So I would say what the antibodies mean and give them statistics and then screen them, do the oral glucose tolerance test, and then talk about their options.
So that's a great segue. What 10 years ago even, we waited. Can we talk about why we just waited? Because, and now why we are screening and why we are, some of it is preventing, some of it is there are treatment options available. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes. Now, I have been doing this for many, many years. And for the vast number of years, actually till November of 2022, we would tell patients that, we want you to be screened because we want you to know that you are at risk so that you know the signs and symptoms of type 1 diabetes so that you do not get diabetic ketoacidosis and get very sick. Now, for the first time ever, we actually have a medication that has been proven to delay the onset of type 1 for at least 2 years. Interestingly enough, Dr. Harold, who was the prime researcher for this, worked with me at the University of Chicago when he was just looking into this many years ago, and his mantra was that I have diabetes, and if my children get diabetes, I want to find a way to prevent it, and he did. So what we now can tell families, before we would say, do you want to know or you don't want to know? And you would think that everyone would want to know, but that is not the case. Because if you know, it's like having the sword of Damocles hanging over your neck, and anytime your child would urinate a lot or do something that may be an onset of illness, families would go really crazy by checking urine, checking blood sugars. But now we can say, okay, we have a medication that we can do to that has been FDA approved and shown to be effective to delay the onset of type 1 diabetes for several years. So it's a totally different approach now. And it's a very exciting advancement, especially for the many, many years that we've been saying there's no option available.
Yeah, no, it's an exciting, very exciting time. So what do you think, what can healthcare professionals do to kind of help increase screening? Because it sounds like now, we have a treatment option. So screening more at-risk people would really help, but like, how do we actually implement this?
Well, let's go back to other diseases that we've screened for. One comes to mind is cystic fibrosis. Now, cystic fibrosis is an autosomal recessive disorder that is life-threatening. And interestingly enough, they just discovered a drug, which also called Trikafta, which does change things enormously for them. So what I'm saying, that knowing that, and you have medication to treat it, should prompt everyone, American Academy of Pediatrics, any of the ART children's advocacy groups, to start doing some screening at well child visits. And I'm actually, when I speak with my colleagues, general pediatricians, I think this should be implemented as part of a well child check and for general guidelines along with CBCs, I'm not saying to do this when they're initially born like you would do for thyroid or something like that. But I think starting at maybe at 1 or 2 years, start doing screening. What's the harm? This is the general population where most people don't even know that they're at risk for type 1 diabetes.
Has there been any cost-effective analyses? Because I'm just thinking, I keep in my mind that 1 in 300, obviously performing this test, I think it's low cost, but there's some cost. Has anyone looked into that?
I don't think they may have, but I'm not aware of anything as of yet. And I think it will be looked at very soon because now we have a treatment for it. So if you want to do a cost-effective analysis, just go look at the expense of admitting someone in DKA right. and in a, have an ICU admission with as well as a move to the general teaching floor where we have to spend time doing diabetes education and then all the follow-up. So it clearly, by preventing the onset of diabetes, even for several years, will markedly improve the cost-effectiveness.
Yeah, that's a good point. And hopefully this is the tip of the iceberg. I mean, with teplizumab, hopefully there's going to be, you know, more, even more therapies coming or extended use of the therapy. And so, yeah, hopefully screening will, you know, make a big difference.
I think that's where, you know, this is the first drug. This is the first, you know, where do we go next is really the question, right? Do you, what do you think about using, and again, what do you think about using monoclonal antibodies in a person that is just diagnosed versus prevention? Do you think that, where do you see this going, the science in general?
Well, I already have a patient that received monoclonal antibodies during a trial, and this kid is, this has been at least 5 years, who was diagnosed with type 1, and he is on insulin. But he's on minimal insulin, and we keep our fingers crossed how long this is going to be. Another thought that I'm thinking is that what happens after 2 years? You'd give the monoclonal, you give the teplizumab or monoclonal antibodies. Why not do it again? I mean, is there any risk of just? I'm not aware of this, and I know they're doing studies at the moment. Repeat, and the longer you can prevent the onset of type 1 diabetes, the better. Everything will be in terms of lifestyle, in terms of quality of life and expense as well as families having less of a burden.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that the potential for this is we've just hit the tip of the iceberg, really. We really, truly have.
Well, we're very, very excited about it because, as I said, I've been at this for more years than I wish to share. And the fact that I can actually offer someone a treatment to delay the onset of type 1 diabetes is to me very miraculous. And I it's just unbelievable. And I only hope that people will do this. You know, just because we have a treatment to offer doesn't necessarily mean that everyone is going to want to adopt it.
Right. No, that's true. I mean, right. Just another question going back to the screening. I'm curious your thoughts on, let's say a person has other autoimmune conditions like the thyroid, maybe celiac disease, but they test negative for all the autoantibodies. Do you think it'd be worthwhile at some point to rescreen again later on?
I would. I mean, the fact is, if you have positive antibodies in either thyroid peroxidase antibodies or transglutaminase antibodies, remember, that is the same location in the chromosome 6, which is the autoimmune HLA region. It is possible you may develop the antibody. So I would certainly routinely do that. I do recommend that for my general pediatricians, you know, who, you know, we see for thyroid and celiac. Certainly the GI people are aware of it as well. Now, I don't know if they routinely screen for anti-pancreatic antibodies, but sometimes they will ask when they have a child that's positive for celiac, should we do so?
And then I know we're talking a lot about kids and pediatricians, but adults, like family medicine, internal medicine, primary care providers, do you think they should start screening some of their adult patients as well for these antibodies?
That's a tough one. I would say I'm not aware that they do ever. Certainly, I would if there's a family history of it. I'm making a judgment. I don't think I would routinely screen for them in the adult population, but I certainly would if anybody's uncle, let's say someone's nephew got diagnosed with type 1, I would certainly recommend screening. And I have recommended screening. And unfortunately, sometimes they turn out to be positive. So in that situation, I definitely would do so.
Yeah, because I know we work in adults, and so it's because of the increase in LADA and the new onset type 1 diabetes in adults, it kind of begs the question, should we do screening in that population too? So
Right. In our practice right now, we are offering you have type 1, you have children. Have they been screened? And most, that's it. No one's been screened at this point because this is all brand new. So we are giving handouts and saying, how do you want to get this done? And we're sending them back through people with a first degree relative. We're sending back through TrialNet because that's easy, right? And it's thorough. And then it's the rest of them. So I see someone for Hashimoto's, right? So you have a higher risk. That's a long discussion. It's not a minute in an office. It is a, look, there are other things, and I think we just have to build it into the conversations that we have. I would hate to miss someone.
Well, the other thing is people sometimes don't want to hear it. So I must say that I always feel bad, you know, when I have to give other news, you know, along with diabetes. So for example, I always, when someone has new onset diabetes, I always screen for thyroid antibodies and celiac antibodies. And if there's any hint of arthritis, you know, JRA, as well as adrenal insufficiency, if there's anything I have to worry about. And then when I get a positive test, particularly for celiac, because that's a lifestyle change, I dread making that phone call because you're adding another burden to the family along with the diabetes. Thyroid, not so much, because basically it's, if hypothyroidism is a pill, and I express it that way, it's just another pill. You don't really have to do anything else.
It is a difficult conversation sometimes, right? And it is but we need to know, right? So I think that's a patient-to-patient decision. I believe that as clinicians, we should be offering options and letting the patient take that stand and do something about it if they choose to.
I agree, to your point, options, right? There's lots of different options, and that's what's made working a diabetes so, I mean, really exciting. It's a very exciting time. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been an amazing discussion. Really, really appreciate all your expertise.
Wow, what an amazing discussion with Dr. Kogan.
Yeah, she's really knowledgeable about the screening.
She is. And I, you know, I think that there's a lot of takeaways from that. One is, if we only screen people that have a first degree relative with type 1, we're missing the majority of who may be positive.
Right. It's interesting. Yeah, I found this statistic of the 1 in 300, and it sounds like it's increasing. So that might be the statistic now, but it could be more people developing or at risk of type 1 diabetes. So should we be screening everyone? I kind of like the idea of a new, like in childhood screening for it, but I'm really curious to eventually see kind of cost effectiveness data to see how that would kind of play out on a population level.
Right. And in adult endo, we think about it as, how are we approaching the people that come in with us with not only just type 1, but also thyroid disease and other autoimmune diseases, and have that discussion in a timely way and encourage them to make those decisions in their own families.
Yeah, I see a real opportunity there. Those that we manage that, like, for example, have thyroid conditions, that we could be screening them and their family members. I think on a broader scale, I'm just very interested in this just because we do see so much adult onset type 1 diabetes. I think one of the challenges is, by the time we see it, it's often they have had it for a little while, and it often got misdiagnosed as type 2 diabetes. So at least at this point, we wouldn't have an active treatment. Now, that might change in the future, that we would have a treatment and where it would be very beneficial. On a practical level, you know, people want to know if they have type 1 or type 2 diabetes because it's going to affect how we manage it. But I'd love to figure out how in adults we could do more screening for those that are high risk.
Right, right. And do it consistently. How do we identify the people at the highest risk and get them the opportunity to be screened?
Well, that's a really good point, because I could see this unfortunately leading to more disparities, because big academic centers may do a lot of screening and identify the candidates and get them the treatment. And then other places may not have access to that. And then we're widening disparities in healthcare. So we have to be really careful about that and make sure we're offering universal screening and equitable care across
right.
populations.
Right. And that is a true concern. You know, and then there is also that discussion of, you do have type 1 and you have first degree relatives. So you have someone in front of you with type 1 diabetes that has 3 children, or that, that, and you approach that person and say, this is something you could consider, right? There is a risk. It's, you know, here we are. This is what happens. Discuss all of that and then hand them a handout to go to their primary care to have the blood work done, because their children are not they're not patients in our clinic yet, right? And so some of that, and how many of those people will actually take that material and get it to their children versus decide for their adult children that they don't want to know, they don't want them screened, right? So there is a little bit of how do we make this work for everyone and how do we get that public message out of the importance of screening?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need universal guidelines. And I know organizations like JDRF are working on that, and hopefully we'll have that in place soon, because I could see that if there was a set guidance, okay, this is who you should screen. You screen if one antibody is positive, or two, this is what you do. This is when you rescreen. If two are positive, you make a referral to the endocrinologist. And so if we had that in place, I think it would make it just so much more streamlined and everyone would feel more comfortable with the process.
And I think that's a big part of it. When we think about, if you do have two antibodies, you even though you have insulin challenges with mealtime glucose control, right? So that's the first thing that goes, right? That dysglycemia that she talked about is when you consume carbohydrates in a higher amount rather than the fasting. And what do we do? What do we screen for? Fasting glucose, right? So I think we have to rethink about how we do things. And then that person is still seen in their primary care office. They're going to become ours though, right? So we should be taking them. I believe that we should be taking them into our clinic at that point, even if we're not doing anything with their management at that time, because we're going to be able to do that education and help them understand where they are, what their risks are. And do you have room in your clinic to do that?
Well, I think it's a great idea. And I kind of look at it like it'd be similar to someone who has diabetes, but who's just really well managed, meeting all their targets. So you're going to still see them.
Absolutely.
It's not like you're going to say, oh, just don't ever come back. Right. Of course, you're going to continue seeing them. You're going to continue, you know, checking their A1C, their everything, but you may not have to do any interventions. And I think this is similar. You're going to follow them. You're going to order that oral glucose tolerance test or other metric. And if it's normal, then okay, you'll recheck it in 6 months or a year or whatever we all decide is the appropriate amount. I like how she said annually, because to me that made a lot of sense. Although I have to say, if I or my child or, you know, if someone has two positive antibodies, I'd probably like want to be screening every month, you know, but yeah.
And could we do that though? Could we screen where we would say, you know, here is a blood glucose monitor, here is a continuous glucose monitor, do some carb loading, right? Eat some carbohydrates and watch the number, check 1 or 2 hours after a meal, see where you get to, call in those numbers, and then do an official screening once a year. All of this has yet to be determined.
So I was thinking about that, and I obviously, like, I love CGM, so I love the idea of using CGM data, but I was kind of here sitting and thinking, like, what if the person just like eats two bagels? Like, you know,
and we just check them,
And you just check at that time. You're like, oh, the CGM showed they went up to 160. They're having some dysglycemia. But like, really, it was two bagels at one time. So like, I guess there would have to be some standardization with it.
Absolutely.
You couldn't just like maybe only look at that. Yeah.
Maybe then you do a glucose tolerance test, because they're not fun.
No
one goes and
not.
Says, let me do another glucose tolerance test. Right. So maybe we do. And it'll be interesting about the guidelines with that. Right. Do the guidelines say, do a carbo load and do CGM or finger stick, and then in the outpatient setting, and then for those that can, and then if that's positive, then we do a glucose tolerance
test. So that's
a
really good idea. So CGM is kind of like the screening.
Right.
And that way you could, there's nothing to stop someone from wearing it. And then when you start to notice some dysglycemia on there, that's when you could do the OGTT.
And maybe they don't have to wear it all the time. Maybe it's a couple of weeks or however long, every couple of months or every 6 months, depending on what's on their situation.
I love it. Oh, there we go. We
figured
it out.
Wrapping technology into, exactly. We've written the guidelines.
Once every 3 months. And if it's dysglycemia, they go get the OGTT.
They go, and then we can diagnose it, right?
Yeah.
Because you're never going to diagnose saying ate two bagels and it's 168, right?
Yeah, I mean, there we go.
There
now
we go,
I've got,
But I do believe that that allows that person to live the way they want to live and do it on their own terms, as opposed to showing up fasting, drinking glucola or whatever right. they're using nowadays. And
Or
and
just not checking and then unfortunately right. presenting in DKA.
Right.
So that would be a great, yeah, great tool.
It's exciting time. It really is.
It is. Well, thanks so much for chatting about this yes. as always. And I want to also thank our audience for tuning in. If you enjoyed the content, please subscribe to our e-newsletter to receive upcoming MedCast episodes and other great content in your inbox.